From the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Dan Richards. Even for an election year, the political news in the United States has been head-spinning over the last few months.
Never has anything like this happened before. Historic, unprecedented felony conviction of Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States.
I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
We're covering the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump at a campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania.
Vice President Kamala Harris made history yesterday, officially becoming the first woman of color at the top of a major party ticket.
I accept your nomination to be president of the United States.
Law enforcement speaking about what is being investigated as a possible second attempted assassination of former President Trump.
For avid followers of the news, it has been a roller coaster. And for Americans who maybe don't follow politics as much, but are starting to as the election approaches, well, I don't know how all this sounds to them.
They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats.
So on this episode, we spoke with someone who could help us make sense of this election as it enters its home stretch. But more than that, this guest is also a deep thinker about how political news works in America, how it's made, how it's consumed, and how it in turn shapes our politics. Isaac Dover is a senior reporter for CNN based in Washington covering Democratic politics. Prior to working at CNN, he was a staff writer at The Atlantic, and before that, he served as Politico's chief Washington correspondent. He is also a senior fellow at the Watson Institute, where he teaches a class on political journalism. We talked about how this election is being covered in the press, how political journalism has changed since Trump first ran for president, and how to stay informed without getting totally overwhelmed. Here's our conversation. Isaac Dover, thank you so much for coming on to Trending Globally.
I'm glad to be here.
So a lot of people have been worried about the 2024 campaign season for a long time, not just the outcome, but, you know, the intensity of the race itself and its effect on our country. And now it's here. Here we are. As someone who covers American politics closely, how has this election felt to you compared to recent previous elections? Does it feel meaningfully different in certain ways, or is it a little bit, you know, more of the same compared to the last few elections?
I think it's fair to say that we've been in a sort of existential moment for this country and American politics since 2016, and that has played out in a lot of different ways, but it taps into things that are going on specifically in America and some that are going on everywhere in the world, right? With economic trends and AI and immigration and all of these things that are changing the world that we live in and are reverberating through politics everywhere. But this election, for a long time, you're right, did feel like a major moment in itself. I think because it looks to people like this would be an election where either Donald Trump will come back into office and be a less restrained, maybe truer version of himself and of the presidency that he wanted in his first term. He talks a fair amount about how he feels like there were people that were holding him back or that he didn't do everything that he wanted to do. I think that's only accentuated over the course of his own campaigning. And truly, I think at its core, a question of, are we going in a Trump direction or a not Trump direction? But the change on the Democratic side reflects something else, which is the possibility that Harris has tried to get people to believe in, that she would be what she calls turning the page or unburdened. And what she means by that is obviously in a political sense, not doing more Trump, the we're not going back line that she uses at rallies. But it actually represents a real break from the politics that we've been in for the last 10 years, which has been dominated by Trump, but by people who are older, are 75 and up. Joe Biden will turn 82 this November. The way he thinks about the world, just like it's true for any of us, is shaped by the world that he was living in then. It's true for Donald Trump, too. When he talks about make America great again, he's referring to what his idea of America was as he was growing up, right? And Harris is going to turn 60 in October. So she's not like a new generation person, but she is a new generation compared to the generation that's been in power.
Yeah, so in a number of ways, it seems different from the last time and a little bit hard to predict how it's going to unfold.
Yeah, definitely. And look, whatever one thinks of Joe Biden, good or bad, eloquent or ineloquent or whatever else, he has a line that he likes to use a lot, which is that we're at an inflection point for this country where the decisions that we make in the next couple of years will define and shape what happens for decades to come. He says these don't come along often. And that's true. That's just true. And it's true in discrete policy ways. What are we going to do about immigration laws in this country? But also, what direction we're going in climate change and fighting it? What does the overall economic outlook of America look like? What is, when it comes to democratic rules and norms, what do those look like? This will be defining in so many ways. And it really is a different world that we're living in if you fast forward to 2 years from now, if Harris wins versus if Trump wins.
You teach a class at the Watson Institute about the relationship between political journalism and the media and American politics. And I want to talk to you some about how you think about the relationship between how we get our news about politics and how it shapes, you know, our politics and how that's all been changing. So let's just start with something you reported on recently. You wrote a piece for CNN earlier this month that said that Vice President Harris and her aides or many around her tend to be, quote, dismissive of the value of traditional media. And while her campaign says to expect more appearances in the press soon, at this moment, she's really only taped a handful of interviews and even fewer with traditional, you know, what we might call mainstream national outlets. The same is true for Donald Trump. So what does it say about how political news works in the year 2024 that, you know, both of the main candidates for president don't really feel that compelled to engage in sort of traditional media events?
I think what it says is that the attention is more diffuse than ever, that especially in this election with where politics are more broadly and how people are pretty clearly set in their ways for the most part, the sliver of those undecided voters is smaller than ever, right? It's always a little bit overblown, the independents, the undecideds, right? Who's really undecided or who's decided, but they're not saying it out loud, or who's an independent but really only votes for Republicans or really only votes for Democrats. So that's always less in reality than the conversation about it. But when you think about the people who, at this point, weeks before this election, with everything that has gone down and that we've all lived through and whatever that, wherever that's left you in thinking about Donald Trump and wherever that's left you in thinking about Kamala Harris, I do think it's hard for most people to believe that there are folks who are still like, I don't know which one, but there are. Now, if you think about who those people are they people who are plugging into any of the traditional news outlets or any of the, forget about mainstream, any of the slanted news outlets? And so it becomes ever more important for these campaigns to reach out to voters who either are truly undecided or are not engaged, who say, I don't ever vote, or I don't really feel like voting this time. And it should be said that one of the things that powered Barack Obama in 2008, especially, but also in 2012, is that there are people who showed up only to vote for him. Right. And in the 2010 and 2014 midterms, Democrats did very poorly and they for a while couldn't figure it out. There are a bunch of reasons why it happened. But one big factor was that there were voters who turned out for Obama who just didn't show up for Democrats. Likewise, for Donald Trump, there are people who voted in 2016 for Donald Trump who had not voted before. They didn't feel connected to a candidate, and they turned out to vote for him. And then in 2018, the Democrats did really well. Why? Well, in part because there was backlash to Trump, but in part it was that his voters were not showing up to vote for a House candidate or a governor candidate, whatever. In 2020, what we saw was that despite polls that showed Joe Biden much farther ahead in the final days than he ended up being, Trump did really well in a lot of places, right? And part of that seems to be that the polls at that point were not accurately measuring how many only Trump voters there were. My point on this is that you have Obama and Trump both demonstrating what happens when you get voters who are not the usual voters and are not the usual engaged voters to turn out for you. It won Barack Obama two terms. It won Donald Trump one and pretty close to a second term. And so that's why Trump ultimately is going the way that he is, and Harris is too, of trying to reach these voters that are just not the ones that we usually think about.
And what about the debate earlier in September? Do you get the sense that it was maybe more able to break through to voters who are less engaged or undecided? Do you think it was kind of a helpful display for voters of these two candidates?
Well, it was watched by, I think the final number was 67 million people. That's a lot of people. It's hard to tell still how much of an effect it had and what the polling bump, as it's usually talked about, would be. But the initial read from the Harris campaign is that it was going to benefit her because of how things went on stage. That debate was a big moment for her because she had at that point been running for president for 50-ish days. Now it's a little bit more, obviously. And most people, not just in America, most people in Washington didn't really know much about Kamala Harris before she started running for president. And so there was a lot to that debate of people just tuning in to see what they thought of her and whether they could imagine her in the role of president, which is not just about not knowing her. It's also about being a woman. It's about being a Black woman. It's all those things. And seeing how she would be toe-to-toe with Donald Trump. Most people at this point, whether for or against, have a pretty set view of Donald Trump. But there is a feeling that among some people who were wavering and who any candidate would want to lock down, that Trump did not succeed in doing that. That he spoke to his own people, his own voters already, but that there were not really the kinds of things in any of his answers that would take someone who was wavering or undecided and put them firmly in his camp. Whereas for Harris, it does seem like it did some of that. And again, the larger thing that it did was make people feel like, okay, I see a little bit more of her. But yet when you talk to the still undecided voters, they say, okay, well, we saw the convention. We've seen all the stuff she's done in the campaign. We saw the debate. I still have some more questions. And that's how this is going to go. And that's why there are 6+ weeks here left in the campaign. And we'll see what happens over the course of them.
I want to look at one moment in the debate that I think gets to some of these issues of the relationship between politicians and political journalism and how they work together these days. You know, one of the most discussed parts of the debate was around Trump's false statement that Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, had taken to eating residents' domestic pets, dogs and cats.
Millions and millions of people to come into our country and look at what's happening to the towns all over the United States. And a lot of towns don't want to talk. It's not going to be Aurora or Springfield. A lot of towns don't want to talk about it because they're so embarrassed by it. In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
The claim has been thoroughly debunked, but Trump and his vice president continue to really push it. And I wonder, what do you make of that moment? Was it a big mistake for Trump to sort of go there, or did it in some way serve his purposes? And how do you think about that?
Well, Trump believes that whenever we're talking about immigration in any way, that's good for him. And there's outside polling and analysis that suggests that at least some ways he may be right. So he did turn the conversation to that. It is definitely pitting people against immigrants, immigrants of color. Famously, if you remember when he was president, would talk about how he doesn't mind immigrants coming from the right countries, but not from shithole countries. And so the zeroing in on the Haitian population in Ohio does not seem to be a mistake, making people feel like there's something nefarious going on with these people who've come into their community. And it's false. It's just not a true story. This was an important thing, though, that happened because it is a false story that has been pushed with a very political agenda around it. He and J.D. Vance, as you say, have stuck to it. But there's been a lot of journalism, whether it was a CNN reporter who's been spending time in Springfield, Ohio, talking to people there, or Wall Street Journal reporters who went a couple days ago and followed up with the people who were involved in the initial reports that there may have been pets missing, and found, indeed, this is a made-up story. And I think that what is... It should be that journalism is checking what politicians say. Politicians say things all the time that are not true, and they say it for their own political ends. Trump, he complained after the debate that he had been fact-checked, whereas Harris had not been fact-checked. Well, part of the reason for that, if not the full reason for that, is that he said more things that were not true. he said that thing. He said that there are babies that are being aborted after they're born, which is not true. That's why the fact checkers jumped in there. They were the goal there was not to fact check. But they did jump in at moments where they felt that it was egregious, clearly. And I think the larger point is that it's been a complicated thing. We talk about this in class, what Trump has done for political journalism and how it's intensified both the work of journalism and the scrutiny on journalists for not being biased, and that everybody is being held to the same standard. But being held to the same standard means that when someone is egregious in what they're saying falsely, then they have to be checked more.
Do you think that the political press has learned how to sort of better report on misinformation or lies, particularly from Donald Trump in this case, because he seems so effective at using them to kind of promote his issues? Do you sense that journalists have gotten better at that over the last few election cycles, or have they changed their approaches?
There have been changes, and I think that there's been an effort to get better at it. I think everybody is more seasoned in this, and there are a lot of things playing out over the course of 2024 that are playing out differently than they were in 2016, and even during the time that he was president. But he is an anomaly. He is a singular figure, I think, in the history of this country, in our culture. I think that was true before he was president, certainly true after he's president. And it's not like he's one thing and hasn't changed himself over that time. So there is a constant process of adapting and learning.
Are there any examples that come to mind of journalists or interactions or stories that seem to you to have been like a really effective way of dealing with a lie from President Trump?
Well, I think that the fact checking of the debate was one way of doing it, right? I'm just saying, no, that's not true. But there are a lot of them. And I think some of it is kind of internalized by reporters. It's not necessarily even things that are being explicitly said, of just how to approach it when he says something. Even a lot of people who covered Trump in 2015 and into 2016 as if he were just a novelty and entertainment have in the time since said that they made mistakes, that he was running for president and he should have been treated as somebody running for president and held to that same standard as everybody else who's running for president.
I want to look a little bit more also at the changing mediums and the ways Americans are getting their political news. According to a recent Pew poll, about a quarter of Americans now regularly get their news from YouTube. About a third get news from Facebook. Roughly half of TikTok users under 30, which is a very coveted demographic for both campaigns, seem to rely on the app for their news. What are the biggest ways that this sort of transformation in how potential voters are getting news, what are the biggest ways it's kind of changed the process of reporting on politics?
I'm not sure it's changed the process of reporting on politics. It's like user, reader, viewer, whatever, attitudes have changed and habits have changed. And so you have to speak to that. I don't think that there is as big a share of people who are watching an hour-long news program or a 10,000-word or reading a 10,000-word article or whatever it may be, as was the case, let's say, 30 years ago. When I talk to my students, sometimes I say that the game for print journalists, online, whatever, if you're writing, is I'm making the movement with my hand, with my finger. But if you think about the thumb scrolling on a screen, that's what it is. And to keep the thumb moving, right? And so you have to make sure that you are pulling someone through the article. And if you think that you're going to produce something that is going to get someone to watch it for 2 hours straight without getting up to pee or playing a game on their phone at the same time or all the things that we know that we all do, right? And then you're not being realistic. And so you have to think in those terms. There's a I was reading about how in a lot of movies and TV shows now, the device that is being used a lot is like a flashback, so that there's a lot of action right at the beginning. And then it goes, okay, how do we get here? Because viewers want to know in those first couple of minutes whether they care enough to watch. And if it's just like the beginning of a story, as all stories begin, then they're zoning out, right? And so that's, you have to cater to that. It doesn't work to do any of this if people aren't consuming it. Then it's just for your own aggrandizement, essentially.
Are there ways that these newer mediums that use more sort of algorithmic filters and just kind of shorter form content, are there ways that they, you think, have benefited us as a, you know, news consuming public?
Yeah, look, we have more information these days about how people are reading and consuming than we ever had, and viewing and all that stuff. And so you can cater to that better. And I mean, I think you have to have some realistic assumptions about it, which is that no matter what I write about, whoever, Kamala Harris or Donald Trump or anybody in politics, it will probably not be as popular online as something that I would write about Taylor Swift or Selena Gomez or whatever. And so you don't want to be a complete slave to the algorithm, but I think you do want to see, do people actually care about that? Again, it can be informative. It's just what you do with that information.
And at the same time, the audience for a lot of traditional mainstream media outlets, with a few exceptions, has decreased. And as the audience has decreased, there has also been a long-running gradual decrease in trust in mass media. According to a long-running Gallup poll, in 2023, only 32% of Americans expressed a great deal or fair amount of trust in the mass media. That's a tie for the all-time low in this poll. And if you listen to voices on sort of social media and more alternative media sources, you'll often hear a skepticism of national media outlets, that they are large companies more interested in a profit or selling commercials than they are in spreading, you know, the truth. And it can feel more like you're getting a main line to the truth on some smaller, you know, media outlet or YouTube channel or something. Is there any way that organizations are able to kind of reassure news consumers that they can be trusted to be sort of reporting the facts no matter where they point? Or is it kind of a lost cause if someone just doesn't believe the organization?
To me, it's just do the work, you have the facts, do your best to be correct. If it needs a correction, you make the correction, but the proof is in the pudding, right? And most of the news organizations, the mainstream whatever, however you want it, traditional, legacy news, or whatever word you want for it, that have succeeded are those that have excelled at bringing people news, facts, in a compelling way, but in a way that really does aim to inform the viewers as best as possible, or the readers as best as possible.
What do you tell students at Brown University who are interested in getting into journalism? It's a challenging career in a lot of ways, and it's constantly changing. What advice do you give them, or do you tell them to maybe look somewhere else?
I definitely don't tell them to look elsewhere. I say that you should think about what it is that you want to do and why you want to do it, and realize that it is a field that is going through a lot of changes because of the economics and because of the technology. But also when it comes to the work that I do, political journalism, because of the politics, and that it's not clear where things are going to be 5 years from now, and they need to go into it with open eyes. But that said, if they are committed to it, interested in it, then there's a lot of opportunity to do things. But I tell them, the standard thing that I say is to not start in Washington, but to get experience elsewhere and learn how to do reporting outside of the wackiness that is national politics. I started my career as a local reporter in New York. And I think that that was really important for developing my approach to doing reporting. And so I will often say, go find some smaller place geographically, by the way, and business-wise, than a major news organization in Washington. If you want to report about politics, but really if you want to report about anything, it's good to just get your grounding in a place where you'll have the opportunities to do that. Smaller newsrooms always are better for junior reporters, because there are more opportunities there. You could go to journalism school. A lot of people I know who've gone have gotten a lot of value from it. I never went to journalism school. I feel like I got a lot of the necessary training that comes at journalism school from being a community newspaper reporter, from doing things in those early years building up that you just can't get if you're in the middle of the national mix.
And then for viewers of the news, you know, I wonder, do you have any advice for people who want to follow this election? They want to follow it closely. They want to stay informed, but they also want to maybe not be incredibly anxious or lose their sanity in the process. Do you have any recommendations for how to approach consuming the news?
Look, it's going to be a sanity testing couple of weeks in between now and November 5th. And potentially afterwards. Remember, we did not get a winner called of the election in 2020 until a couple days afterwards. And that was a weird, rough period. I spent it in Delaware waiting to see what would happen with Joe Biden. And then the months afterwards were also pretty intense, building up to January 6th, which is, of course, a pretty searing day in American history. So I think if you're paying attention and you care about the results of the election, you're probably not going to have the least anxious period of your life into this fall. However, I think that if you care about the results and you want them to move one way or the other, the political people would say, well, then don't just care about it. Like, take your anxiety and feed it into pushing things one way or the other. I think that we are too engaged in all of this stuff all the time, whether it's through doom scrolling or watching TV or whatever it may be. And you create a level of helplessness. And so if you care enough about where it's going, then you can get involved or just stop reading or watching for a while and go to the movies or whatever it may be. But this is a pretty important election. And I think people should care not just about the final result, but what happens along the way, because it will, even in these final weeks here, continue to define what a presidency for Harris or a second term presidency for Trump would look like. And that's true, both of what will happen with them directly, but also indirectly, right? There are a lot of races going on. What is Kamala Harris going to do as president is a question that is tied in part to, is the House under Democratic control? Is the Senate under Democratic control? Is it under Republican control? What does Donald Trump's presidency look like? Likewise, it has to do with all of those things and governors and what they'll be doing. And so it's going to be a time when a lot of people will be paying attention to the news. I support that. I will be producing the news or some of the news that they will hopefully be consuming. And it's good to pay attention and be informed, but it's also good to pace yourself and, again, translate that anxiety into something other than just reading more or just watching more, because the goal here is not for anybody to completely lose their minds.
That sounds like a great goal, above all. So, Isaac Dover, thank you so much for coming and talking with us on Trending Globally.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This episode was produced by me, Dan Richards, and Zach Hirsch. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. Additional music by the Blue Dot Sessions. If you like the show, leave us a rating and review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps other listeners to find us. And while you're there, be sure to hit the follow button, too. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for guests or topics for the show, send us an email at trendingglobally@brown.edu. Again, that is all one word, trendingglobally@brown.edu. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Trending Globally. Thanks.